This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and let's continue on finding out about how education in Northwest Indiana is going to be conducted. We have talked in recent days with some of the higher education institutions, and we're checking in now with reporters who have covered the public education aspect. With us is Carly Lanich, who is the education reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and as always, Carly, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, some of the big areas that you have carried in your stories in print and online have to deal a lot, not all, but a lot with what's happened in Northlake County, in particular with communities like East Chicago, Merrillville, and the South Central schools. Fill us in on how they are going to be reopening for the new academic year coming up.
Sure. So I'll start with, we're starting to see kind of rolling announcements across the county of districts that are considering an all-virtual start to school. I'm sure you're hearing a lot about that these days. Where it's coming from is just over the weekend, Lake County's health officer, Dr. Chandana Bavilava, released new guidance for schools at the county level. And this guidance is really driving a lot of the decisions we're seeing now being contemplated in our school districts. So that's where we reported a story Monday showing a breakdown of positivity rates and recommendations both at the elementary and secondary school levels in Lake County. And shortly after that guidance went out to school leaders on Friday of last week, we started to see some of these recommendations for virtual learning to come out. So we've covered a number of decisions in school districts. We're seeing some districts, like you mentioned, East Chicago, South Central, over a couple counties, most recently Hammond have opted for virtual learning. Hammond was significant last night. The first district I've seen in Northwest Indiana go for a full semester. Mm-hmm. So those Hammond students, they serve about 13,000 students in Northlake County. Those students, may not be back into a physical school building until after winter break.
Wow. I guess then that's a long time when you think about it, because usually it's the autumn that it seems like the longest time right before Christmas, or certainly before Thanksgiving, before they start taking their holiday breaks. In the decision that the Hammond School Board made, did it seem that they were just so concerned about how being so close to East Chicago, which is a mini hotspot for COVID-19 here in Northwest Indiana, at least, that they're afraid they might spill over into Hammond?
I think there's a little bit of that. When you look through the superintendent's presentation from last night, he broke down community totals specific to Hammond zip codes that showed where the spread is within Hammond. It's important to consider the context of Hammond within the coronavirus pandemic. Hammond was actually one of the first districts in the state to see a case tied to someone in their district. So as schools began to close, Hammond was the first place we saw a school actually have a connection to the virus back in March. Now, as schools are starting to reopen, where we've seen that first entry point has been through athletics. We now know Hammond athletics were put on a suspension. They had some cases, I believe about 5 cases, tied to their summer athletics programs. Mm-hmm. So even though, the numbers may not be percentage to population-wise the same as East Chicago, they're seeing those connections already to their district. And, I'm not speaking for the district, but I really feel the mindset there is we're already seeing this into our school system. Let's go the extra step to shut things down for the time being. Mm-hmm. Now, in Hammond and some other districts, there'll be some exceptions. Most districts that are going virtual, even some of them that are doing 9 weeks or just a couple of weeks, are working within the community to provide options for childcare for some of those younger students. But those opportunities are going fast, so families who are interested really need to reach out now to the providers in their community, to their school districts, for assistance on that.
I know that you mentioned earlier here in one of your articles, too, about some of the other school districts in the region that have made their decisions, East Chicago among them, Highland are among some of the other school districts that have already jumped forward and said, this is what we're going to do. They've try to follow, I guess, the guidelines that Dr. Vavilala has put out. And I also know, too, in the story that you took a look at some of the guidelines that she had put forth, and some of the schools may be able to deal with a little higher connectivity rates with the virus, if it's, I guess, possible to be able to do so, right?
Sure. So part of what we're looking at here, too, as well, is you have to consider that every school community, and just within our county, within Lake County, is very different. What works for, you know, a Lowell Tri-Creek may not work the same as Hammond or Maryville, which we've seen recent announcements come out of. Mm-hmm. So what this guidance does coming out of the Lake County Health Department is it establishes a framework or, a basis for schools to make their decisions on. But it's not a strict order. It's not something that schools have to follow. So we've seen some districts work within these recommendations. Others are saying we're going to try, if we do reopen, to meet them the best we can. A big one that's been, in conversation at the state and local level is the distance between students in a classroom. Many districts, especially a lot of our larger districts, are coming forward and saying, look, we just can't offer proper social distancing in these areas. So, they're turning to very strict mask requirements and following, state orders on mask wearing. That was another difference where Dr. Vavilala's guidance went a step further at the state level. The recommendations or the order, in fact, is that students in grades 3 through 12 wear a mask. Well, here in Lake County, the strong recommendation of the Lake County Health Department is starting even as young as kindergarten with those masks, because Dr. Vavilala has said there's evidence showing that those younger students can maintain them if mask breaks are given. So, like I said before, it's a framework. Every school is interpreting this guidance a little bit differently, mm-hmm. but it is driving some of the recent decisions we've seen.
Now, Carly, I know one of the other stories that you had out there in print and online in the Times about the subject of the pandemic and of schools talks about teachers in particular. We have state leaders with the American Federation of Teachers Union that are taking a very close look as what school districts are doing as far as reopening concern and safety in getting the schools reopened. And tell us about what the thoughts seem to be on the state level that you've discovered and how it fits into local.
Sure. So at the state and even the national level of the American Federation of Teachers, the national convention for the AFT was held in late July. And in this convention, a resolution was put forward basically outlining what teachers want to see in a safe return to school. Mm-hmm. Many of these teachers are saying that they want to get back, but if they go back, they want some, they want some assurance that things are going to be done safely, that PPE is going to be provided, that they will be funded in the additional costs that they'll need under the pandemic. So that's really the basis for the conversation. Now, where state leaders have spoken, they said, especially in Indiana, where schools are some of the first in the nation to start, down in Indianapolis, for example, are already seeing their first cases tied to schools. Teachers are saying, if we can't meet this with an effort of safety, maybe teachers need to walk out. So that's been an interesting conversation to follow. I haven't heard of anything planned at the moment, but it's something that teachers are contemplating if they feel their conditions aren't being met with safe precautions in place.
Well, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose that the AFT Indiana is going to have to keep a very close eye on how all the school districts, especially with teachers that are part of their organization, are having to deal with the reopening of school and how safe and secure they feel, imagine.
Absolutely. And it's also been a contributing factor in some of the decisions we've seen to go virtual for the start of the year. In several districts that I've written about, part of the rationale between doing a virtual start was just the number of teachers that have come forward and said, I am uncomfortable going back, or maybe they fall into a more vulnerable population if they have, a pre-existing health condition or are, of a certain age where they're concerned they may be more susceptible to the virus carried by their students. So, these are all discussions that are, being had both at the national and state level, but also within our own school districts as we see them make decisions on how education will be carried out. Really beginning next week in some districts.
Mm-hmm. Carly Lanich is an education reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Carly, as always, thank you for joining us and bringing us up to date on your stories. And we'll look for more. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Continuing on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio, we talk now with Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune about the stories she's put out there in print and online lately. A lot of them are dealing with not only the Gary Community School Corporation, but with the upcoming referendum, which is a project that has just gotten underway. And as always, Carol, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, let's start out first with your story about a little more about, I guess, in some detail about the proposed $52 million 8-year operating referendum that the Gary Community School Corporation is going to ask of voters in November. And I guess the recent story that you had out from the emergency management team talks more about that. And I'll let you explain this in more detail, and especially the part about the impact of where the money is going to go. And I understand some of the money's not going to go to any of the charter schools in the city of Gary.
Yeah, the emergency manager, who is Paige McNulty, they've dropped the interim from her title, so she is the full-fledged emergency manager now.
Mm-hmm.
She indicated at a meeting a couple weeks ago, I think she was asked about this, that referendum money, if the referendum is approved by voters, will stay within the Gary Community School Corp. There was a amendment to a law last year. Actually, the bill contained language that would allow the Gary schools to defer some $25 million in loans to the state so they could then use that money for capital improvements. Added to that bill was language saying that if school districts win a referendum, they can they may, if they'd like, share that money with charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
And Paige McNulty said, no, that's not going to happen, at least with this referendum.
And we mentioned, and you mentioned here about the money coming from the state loan payments that the Gary schools would have turned in, and how it's being deferred to go toward some capital projects and the like. I know that of the referendum money that is going to focus first on making sure that the teachers get the financial support that they need.
That's what they've said. They said the teachers have not received a raise for over a dozen years, and this referendum money, number one, will go to give them a raise. And beyond that, they're going to work on some security upgrades. They can't really spend it's operating money, so they can't really spend it on capital improvements,
right,
such as a new roof or something like that. It has to be along the lines of something within their operating budget.
Well, certainly we know that the referendum is going to, if it's all, has to be dedicated only to operating funds. Certainly there's enough there that it's going to have to go to the Gary Community School Corporation to pay down the deficit, which they have managed to, I guess, to do, but still has quite a sizable deficit yet to pay.
Yeah, they've got two silos of debt. One is the operating debt, and MGT, which is the contractor for the district right now, has reduced that from about $22 million that they say to about $6 million today, but they have cut everything they can cut, they say, and the best way to close that final stretch of the debt would be through the referendum and the commitment from Gary taxpayers to the school district. So they have to post two straight years of a balanced budget before MGT can exit the district. And MGT folks are saying that passing this referendum will be the best, quickest way to ensure that they get out of the district.
I know that in recent weeks, you mentioned in your story in the Post Tribune that there were a couple live stream discussions about the referendum. They were, I guess, kind of chaired in a way, or at least hosted by Dr. McNulty. And State Representative Vernon Smith, who is an educator in his own right, and the Gary School Teachers Association president were present for those sessions. And we know that Dr. Smith has not been a big fan of the emergency management team, but at least you have to think that he's certainly going to go along with this as long as it's going to help the school corporation.
Yeah, Representative Smith is also a non-voting member of the Distress Unit Appeals Board, which governs the school district at this time. So he's privy to a lot of the information that is being provided by MGT to that board. And in his mind, although he was not in favor of the takeover, he does understand what the law says. And in order to give the district back to the elected leaders, that this would be the fastest way to do it.
Now, you mentioned in your story, and we have, I think, mentioned it at the outset when the announcement was first made from the Gary Community School Corporation about the referendum that they were seeking. We mentioned the first million is going to go towards the teachers. They haven't gotten a raise in, 12 years, I think, quite a while. Mm-hmm. What's some of the other money that will be raised from the referendum going to go to, as far as we know right now?
They're saying they've also raised the amount that they're seeking. It's at about $71 million over 8 years, which is about $9 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't been real specific. They are saying that they would do some security upgrades that would be camera systems and other enhancements at schools to make them more safe. Well, to make them safer than they are right now, as well as other upgrades inside schools that need them that aren't necessarily capital projects, but would enhance academics.
What does it seem, I guess, we're going to see on the ballot in November, now that we know that the referendum has been approved, at least for being on the ballot in November? What's the language likely to be like?
I think it'll be straightforward. They're pretty much boilerplate, the way mm-hmm. these referendums are phrased in legal terms that probably none of the voters will actually understand it. But it would be like, should the taxpayers of the Gary Community School Corporation approve the $8.9 million referendum request over 8 years? Probably something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned here that Dr. Smith, who was a member, that you say the non-voting member on the DUAB, is not a big fan of the emergency management team, but he's gone along with the referendum. But they do have some very strong supporters, at least one's come out recently in one of your other stories that you had in the Post Tribune. This is about the Ministerial Association. Tell us about that.
Yeah, on Sunday they had a praise service outside at Frable Park, and the Baptist Ministers Association gave their full-throated support to the referendum, so that was a big boost, I guess. I don't want to call it a rally. That service was attended by Paige McNulty, and she spoke, and they even suggested that they should ask for more money.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that it's a matter that is really taken up by the voters and the school corporation, in this case MGT, the emergency management team. Have gotten any kind of clue as to what the city government has to say about the referendum? Are they in support or just going to sit back and watch, see what happens?
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be the latter. Mm-hmm. I'm told by Jerome Prince's spokesman that the mayor is not going to take a stand. He's going to let the voters decide.
Now, I guess it's that he's taking this wait-and-see attitude, but I know that there are some people, certainly on city council or people who have been involved in city council, that are a little concerned about it.
I understand that they may not get the full backing of the city council. I know that they won't get the backing of their advisory board, which mm-hmm. once was the elected school board. That they were devolved into that advisory role by the takeover law. And many of them, including Robert Buggs, who's their president, is dead set against the referendum.
Now, one other story that you had out there in print online to take a look at involving the Gary Community Schools talks about a change in leadership. Fill us in on that first.
They have hired a new chief academic officer, and her name is Kim Bradley. She's She was with McNulty when she was the superintendent at the East Chicago School District.
Mm-hmm.
And she came over more recently to work in the federal programs department in Gary. And she has just been elevated into this new role as chief academic officer. The second hire is a chief financial officer, and her name's Nicole Wolverton. And she comes from Sender & Company. That's the accounting firm that has been handling Gary's finances since Lisa Rosinko, who was the former CFO, left in she left in May, and she's now with the Northwest Indiana Special Education Cooperative.
Let me ask you while I have a chance here, Carol. We know that there have been problems in some of the abandoned Gary Community School Corporation buildings. They've been seemed to have an awful lot of arson fires lately that the fire department has had to look into. And there was for a while, I know, the effort that the City Hall had was to try to sell some of these buildings. And, of course, then the coronavirus pandemic had a habit of getting in the way. They kind of put it on hold, but I understand they're going to pick back up again. They're going to try and do another auction or another opportunity to buy the buildings?
They had announced in, I believe it was March, right before the pandemic,
yeah,
that they had offers on all 24 buildings or properties that they had put up for sale, and then they released all the offerings that they had, and then we got the pandemic, and everything got put on hold. And I asked them recently, what's going to happen with that, because people have to secure funding and all that to buy these buildings. And they indicated that they would be starting that sale process again. They told me it would be in July, and we're in August, and
yeah,
it still hasn't started. So I'm not sure what the timeline is on that.
Well, at least it's still in their minds. They're not going to let it go just because we have the pandemic and things are kind of on hold.
Yeah. Well, I would think they would love to, gind some income from selling the building to lower their debt ratio.
Sure. Well, we'll hope there'll be a story coming out in the Post-Tribune about that before too long. And, Carol, thank you for spending time with us to talk about these stories that you've had out there.
Thank you, Chris.
Carol Carlson's a reporter for the Post-Tribune, and she spent time going through some of the stories with the Gary Community School Corporation lately about the referendum vote that is going to be on the ballot in November. And this is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's turn now to Hannah Reed with the Post-Tribune on stories of issues involving education here in Northwest Indiana recently. It's, of course, all tied together with the coronavirus pandemic. And, Hannah, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, one of the stories that you have here is talking about how parents seem to be reacting to the decisions that are being made by school district officials about deciding whether they're going to go into school in person or go to do it hybridly, that is a mix of virtual and online learning and that sort of thing here. Tell us more about the comments that you got from parents here in Northwest Indiana about the whole issue.
Yeah, so back before, a lot of districts now have opted to go all virtual for the first nine, four, unspecific time for school. But before that, there were a lot of parents in the area who were grappling with the decision on whether or not to send their children to in-person classes or online.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically what happened was the schools gave them the choice between, doing e-learning or just sending their children back to school in person. And they were just kind of going through the motions, trying to research as much as they could to see what would be best for their children and how it would work out for them.
I know you had a chance to talk with some individuals, and in particular with Sally Siega. Tell us more about Sally, about her child, and about the prospects of being back in school.
Yeah, Sally has two children in the Lake Central School Corporation, and she said that she kind of went back and forth between what she wanted to do for her children. Originally, she was going to do online, and then she switched to in person, it was in person, online, in person. And her original decision was to send them to school, but then she was reading the material she sent. She got uncomfortable. She decided to change her mind and keep the kids at home, but then she felt uncomfortable with that as well. And she said after watching the school board meeting, she contacted the school to give them her final decision to send her children ages 18 and 13 back to in-person learning, which she said that they were pretty happy about.
I know that one of her children has problems in dealing with some of the pandemic's outcome and the things that we have to do, like wearing masks and all.
One of her children has an IEP, and so if he were to do school virtually, she said that she wasn't sure how the IEP would work for him. And he would prefer in-person classes, and she said he was really worried about having to do classes at home, and she didn't realize how much her decision to tell him that he might be staying at home affected him. And she said as soon as she told him he was going to be back in person, he seemed happier. He was excited to get back to school and, you know, get back to his education.
One of the other people you had a chance to talk to for your story in the Post-Tribune is Erica Bizon, if I'm pronouncing her last name correctly. Tell us about Erica and her children and the concerns that the parents have about going back into school.
Yeah, Erica is immunocompromised, and so while some have decided to turn to in-person learning, she has to keep her children at home just to, you know, lower that risk of any of her family getting the virus. And she said when she told her second and third grader that they were going to be staying home, she expected them to want to return to school, but she found it was the opposite. They didn't want to wear the masks, so they were kind of excited to not have to do that. And she basically said she has to wait until there's a vaccine to be able to send her children back to regular in-person classes.
Mm-hmm. I guess the concern is mostly, I guess, because of what would be to her own health, I suppose, as much as her children.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. That was something that she told me, too. She was just, for her health, she could not have them go to school just in case they were to, you know, bring it back home to her somehow.
Mm-hmm. And you also had a chance to talk with another resident not far away in Munster, Karen Jennings. Tell us about Karen, her family, and the concerns that they have, too, about going back either into school or having to do some other type of learning.
Yes, so I actually talked to Karen Jennings at the School Town of Munster board meeting where they, you know, decided what they were going to do for the school year. And she says she is going to opt to send her child to do online learning for the upcoming school year. She doesn't think that, you know, students should be returning to in-person classes, and with everything that's going on and the case numbers, she thinks the first quarter at least should be remote learning. And although the whole district's not doing that, she is doing that for her child.
Now, will you have a chance to catch up with some of the parents that you've had a chance to talk to for your stories?
Yeah, I hope to reach out to them sometime early next week, probably. You know, districts are still deciding what they're doing, and once I get, you know, a compiled list of all what they're doing, I'll probably reach out and see if any of their minds have changed, you know, how things are going for them in terms of that.
Well, Hannah, thank you very much for spending time talking with us about the story that you have in particular, a very interesting story. Several parents that have youngsters in different school districts here in Northwest Indiana, and their concerns, some are very much the same as others here in the region about starting in with in-person learning or having to go to a hybrid of some kind with either virtual or with online learning as classes decisions for them, at least, are being made these days. And we hope to have you back in, talk about more conversations with the people that you've talked to here just recently, and maybe with some more people too.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Hannah Reed is a reporter for the Post-Tribune. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to our reporters and participants in the program. And coming up on Monday on Regionally Speaking, we'll bring you a conversation with a singer-songwriter and the founder of Positive Vibes Only, R.J. Griffith. They have another drive-through program coming up in East Chicago, and he'll talk about that. We hope you can join us for the conversation.